Hello, this is Dean Kernut, and welcome to the Alpha Exchange, where we explore topics in financial markets associated with managing risk, generating return, and the deployment of capital in the alternative investment industry. Michael Pettis is no stranger to episodes of financial crisis. Trading through multiple Latin American debt crises in the 80s, the Southeast Asia currency debacle in 1997, and in its aftermath, the capital flight that engulfed Brazil, Michael has developed a rigorous framework for the how and why of these disruption events. Central to his approach is Hyman Minsky's focus on the balance sheet and the relationship between assets and liabilities, both for individual entities and across the system. Driving financial fragility, in Michael's rendering, is a specific type of mismatch in which payments on the liability side are vulnerable to sharply increasing when conditions become less favorable. Our conversation considers these events in the context of China, a country that Michael moved to in 2002 and has become a renowned expert on. Seeing China on an unsustainable debt path as early as 2007, Michael argues that the conditions for financial crisis are less obvious given the closed nature of the Chinese banking system and the powerful ability of regulators to be able to force the creditors to restructure. Michael has plenty to share on a number of other important topics, including MMT and his recent book, Trade Wars Are Class Wars, in which he lays out the impact of globalization on wages and the resulting shift of political tides in the U.S. and abroad. Please enjoy this episode of the Alpha Exchange, my discussion with Michael Pettis. My guest today on the Alpha Exchange is Michael Pettis. He is a finance professor at Peking University. He's also a senior fellow at the Carnegie Tsinghua Center. Michael, it's great to have you on the Alpha Exchange today.
Thanks very much, Dean. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, we got to know each other several years ago and interacted a couple of times just around your expertise, deep expertise on the Chinese economy. But you've also got quite a long and successful career on Wall Street and traded through a lot of episodes of financial market crisis. Why don't you give us a little bit of retrospective on your career, how you got started and some of the early days in which you found yourself amidst volatility events?
When I got out of business school, I went to Columbia, and because I'd spent much of my youth in living in different countries, including many years in Spain and in Latin America, so of course I spoke Spanish in Latin America, I lived in Peru and in Haiti. When I graduated, I wanted to do something related to Latin America finance, Latin America business, but that was the time of the so-called LDC debt crisis. It was really, really difficult to get a job doing anything to do with Latin America, particularly in finance. So I ended up working for Mellon Bank, where I developed this portfolio of Japanese broker-dealers, and that was doing extremely well. And this was at a time when it was widely expected that Japanese broker-dealers were going to end up doing what Toyota did to the American finance industry, and that they were going to become the most important players, et cetera, et cetera. And I remember in 1988 or something, I read an article about all these weird people doing Latin American debt swaps. So I wrote a letter to every single person in the article and managed to get a job at Manufacturers Hanover doing debt equity swaps in Mexico. And I mentioned that because it was interesting the reaction that everybody had, including even my parents. Everyone told me, you're crazy to leave Japan because Japan is clearly the future of the world. It will become the world's largest economy. The Japanese banks will dominate the financial sector. You're sitting on this great portfolio, and you're leaving it to do Latin America, which is dead, 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 and never coming back. But I was very stubborn, so I went ahead and did it. And, of course, the punchline you already know, which is that within 2 or 3 years, Japan began its great big decline from 17% of global GDP to roughly, I think it's today, it's around 7%. Meanwhile, Latin America became the hottest market on Wall Street. And one of the really important lessons that I learned there, which I think it takes, the more experience you have, the more you learn it, is that we really don't know very much. Our ability to make these long-term predictions has been terrible in the past. And I think that was a very important lesson I learned when I came to China. But anyway, to continue, I traded the restructured debt in Latin America, and those became bonds, and I ran bond trading desks at First Boston, at Bear Stearns. I also started up the capital markets efforts. And it was all very exciting stuff in the beginning, but it got a little bit towards the end. By the end of the 1990s, it had stopped being a real cowboy market, and it became a very cookie-cutter market. And that's when I decided, at the time I was a principal at Bear Stearns running the Latin American capital markets and the liability management teams, and I decided to try to do something different. And I moved to China. The plan was to teach for 2 years and then return to Wall Street, having declared myself a China expert. But that was in 2002, and I've never really left. It's been too interesting to leave, so I've continued teaching in China for the past 18 years, focused much of my attention on the Chinese financial markets. And I think the advantage that I brought to China is when I came, most China experts treated China pretty much as a sui generis economy, something that had never happened before. And certainly the idea that having a background in developing countries or in Latin America would be at all useful in understanding China was, I think, considered quite silly. China was different. There was nothing like China. And of course, the more financial history and economic history you read, the more suspicious you become of any claim like that. And it turns out that China has many of the strengths and weaknesses of any large developing country. And that Latin American background turned out to be very, very useful in understanding things about China that I think a lot of economists that focus just on China never really understood. So I think that varied background turned out to be quite useful.
As we continue our conversation and have so much to dive into about the Chinese growth experiment and sort of where the U.S. and China are in terms of relations, you've developed a pretty unique philosophy on risk over the years. And I remember back during the sovereign debt crisis, I was trying to just understand more about the history of debt crises. And I came across your book, The Volatility Machine. And I'm just wondering if you can lay out a little bit of, as you managed risk through multiple Latin American debt crises, and you've seen your fair share of them globally, what are the types of things that have been formative for you with regard to perhaps the behavior of asset prices and so forth in terms of managing risk? How has your risk philosophy come together over the years?
Well, because I started my Wall Street career really in the end of the LDC, the so-called LDC debt crisis, the whole issue of sovereign risk and debt crises was a very important one. And like most other people, I turned to economists to try to understand it. But I very quickly understood that economists just don't understand debt, let alone developing countries. There really isn't a clear understanding of debt and the way balance sheets work. And I was very lucky because I started reading a lot about the history of financial crises. And that led me to Charles Kindleberg, and Kindleberg led me on to Hyman Minsky, who I think is probably the most important economist we have since Keynes, and who's only very recently started to become known. For a long time, his work was largely ignored. Hyman Minsky really focused on balance sheets. His most important insight, in my opinion, is not the Minsky moment, whatever that is, or the financial instability hypothesis, which is quite important, but his most important insight was to consider that every economic entity, starting at the level of the individual going to the global economy, is basically a kind of bank with assets and liabilities. And the interrelationship within the economy takes place through these balance sheets. So my assets can be your liabilities or vice versa. And Hyman Minsky focused very, very heavily on the relationship between, if for individual entities, the relationship between assets and liabilities for that entity, and then systemically, the relationship between assets and liabilities across the system. That's really, it's Kindleberg and Minsky that really drove, I think, much of what came out in that book, The Volatility Machine, where I argued that financial crises were not a function of excessive debt or even of insolvency, although excessive debt was a condition that could lead to increasing financial fragility. But for me, what drove financial fragility was a particular type of mismatch between the asset and the liability side of the balance sheet. I started my career at Mellon Bank, which is a AAA bank, but my career really began when I joined Manufacturers Hanover, which, like most of the other largest American banks, was technically insolvent. And yet they didn't have a crisis. And I would argue they didn't have a crisis because basically the Fed was able to restructure their liabilities in such a way to prevent the mismatch on the balance sheet from mattering. the point I would make is that it isn't too much debt that creates the risk of a financial crisis. It's the way the payments on the liability side of the balance sheet are indexed to the revenues on the asset side of the balance sheet. Now, that all sounds very complicated, but it's actually quite simple. The classic mismatch case is, say, Korean companies in 1995, 1996, borrowing dollars to invest in won assets. Now, the way that works is when all of these dollars were flowing into South Korea, the South Korea economy was booming, and the value of the assets was rising. Interestingly enough, because the won was strengthening in real terms, the cost of dollar liabilities kept dropping. Korean companies found themselves in this wonderful virtuous circle where the more they borrowed dollars, the more the value of their assets went up and the cost of their liabilities went down. So they benefited on both sides of the balance sheet. But I call that an inverted balance sheet because it's highly risky, it's highly volatile. And as soon as conditions reverse, which happened basically in the middle of 1997 when Thailand appreciated the baht, then you see the opposite effect of that relationship, where as there was increasing downward pressure on the value of the won against the dollar, the only way South Korean companies could respond to that was to sell assets and use the proceeds to hedge by buying dollars. And of course, as they sold assets, the value of the assets dropped. Eventually, when the currency broke, the cost of the liabilities soared. So for me, that's what I would call an inverted balance sheet. And it's those kind of balance sheets that make entities highly liable, highly likely to have debt crises or financial crises. It's an inverted relationship between the revenues on the asset side and the costs on the liability side. And much of that book was written basically to explain why you are likely to have financial crises in developing countries and why once you do have a financial crisis, there is a tendency to blame incorrectly the development model that the country was following. And the point is, it's not economics that drives these crises. It's the balance sheet mismatch that drives these crises.
Sometimes when you look at FX to equity relationships for EM countries, and I think what you're pointing to is you see this sometimes very virtuous correlation and sometimes quite destructive correlation on the unwind. It does appear in the aftermath of the Asian contagion of 1997 that some of these, or most of the EM countries, have run their liability mismatch a little bit more carefully, and they built up a stockpile of FX reserves, not wanting that to happen again. Do you feel like there's those types of vulnerabilities currently in the financial system that are really worth keeping your eye on?
Well, I think the concern about the currency mismatch after the 1997 crisis, followed by Brazil in 98, has made people much more worried about having that type of mismatch. But the problem is that they then put into place other types of mismatches. So I'll give you two stories about that. The first story is, again, is a currency mismatch. Back in 1997, I remember going to Brazil and talking to the head of the central bank there, Gustavo Franco, and saying we would be able to raise $500 million of five-year funding for you at 19% and $1 billion at actually lower, probably 18 or 17% because it would have been more liquid. Now, at the time, the one-year borrowing cost in Brazil was around 20, 21%, and it had come down dramatically in the last couple of years from around 40%. This is not dollar funding. This is real funding. We could have issued real bonds in the international markets for 5 years at 100 to 200 basis points below the one-year rate. His response was, look, we're doing everything right. We've brought interest rates down from 40% to 21%, and in another year, they're going to be 12%. So why the hell would we be so stupid so as to borrow at 5 years at 18% or 19% when in a year interest rates may be much, much lower? And I tried to explain to him that, of course, I didn't say you're wrong. As a banker, you never say that. I said, you're probably right. But if it turns out that you are right and interest rates are much, much lower, that means everything has turned out positively for Brazil. And the fact that you locked in this high borrowing cost at 19%, well, it's a problem, but it'll be a very minor problem. Things will have been going so well that it doesn't really matter. But in the case that things go wrong, and you have to be very careful how you say this as a banker, because you can't in any way imply that things will go wrong for reasons of for things that the government did. In the case things go wrong, then you may be, when you really, really need the relief, you may be very relieved that you're able to borrow 5 years at 18% because interest rates might go much, much higher. Well, basically, they threw us out of the office. They said, there's absolutely no way. This is ridiculous. Borrowing 5 years at 18% simply won't make sense. Well, the punchline, of course, is that within 6 months, interest rates were back up to 40%. And Brazil was suffering from a real crisis. In fact, they had to devalue the currency and the whole bit. And I would argue that there was a really important lesson there, because when things are going well, there is a tendency for governments to say, things are going well because we are doing the right things, and because we will continue to do the right things, things will continue to improve. So we shouldn't hedge our bets. We should bet very, very heavily on a systematic improvement of all of the conditions. And it's very hard to break out of that psychology. I said there were two stories. The other story is a very Chinese story, and that is that in the 1980s and 1990s, as China got much richer and much more urbanized, not surprisingly, real estate prices started to rise quite quickly. And after several years of rising quickly, if you are a business and you need to expand, let's say you need to buy one more acre of land to expand, some businesses bought one more acre. Other businesses that were much more speculative in their approach would go out and buy 2 acres. And as the price of land continued to rise, the speculators, the ones that took the more speculative approach and bought more land than they needed, did much better over the medium term than the more prudent investors who bought the right amount of land. And so their profitability was better because as they continued to expand, they were able to expand with much cheaper land that they had bought earlier. And so you lock in this process in which the more speculative component of the economy in a period of rising prices tends to outperform the more prudent and certainly outperform the excessively prudent. And so you see a big shift in the direction of the economy towards increasingly higher levels of risk-taking. Everybody with a business ends up speculating on land. Now, that's really great when land prices are going up forever. The problem with that kind of strategy is that should conditions ever turn, and God forbid, land prices start to go down, you're now on the opposite side of that balance sheet structure where the economy is slowing and you're earning less and less. And at the same time, the fact that you overinvested in land is now starting to cost you very heavily because land prices are going down. So the point of all of that was to suggest that there are reasons that tend to lock us into creating these highly unstable balance sheets. And what we needed to think about much more rigorously was how we systemically tend to create risky balance sheets and what the implications are for future volatility. And basically, I don't need to tell you, what happens is that when things are going well, these unstable balance sheets make it even better. But the moment things turn around, these unstable balance sheets make everything much, much worse. And that's what I call the volatility machine.
Yeah, I've always thought about vol events are the markets coming to grips with mistaken assumptions, what they thought was true and very strongly thought that things were quite good gets unwound. And when people need to react and do so in a hurry, that's when you get asset price movements that are quite volatile. There's been a lot of talk over many, many years on China and its accumulation of debt. It's been something that's been written about by the IMF, the BIS, and probably every sell-side strategist that covers the region over the last many years. I'm hoping that you can give us your rendering of the accumulation of debt in China over the period leading into COVID, and maybe give us your view on how China was doing in this previous period. And then we can kind of pivot to the now. What's your take on where China was, let's say, at the end of 2019, just in terms of growth and then maybe some of the debt concerns?
Well, we have to go back further because this is a much older problem. In fact, by 2006, 2007, 2008, it should have been very obvious that China was on an unsustainable debt path. It was a very tough argument to make because most economists would tell you, no, you're misunderstanding China. The Chinese don't do debt. It's total nonsense. But the reason I would argue that China was on an unsustainable debt path back then, again, there are a lot of similar cases in recent financial history of countries that did the same thing. Basically, in the 1980s, when Deng Xiaoping's reforms were first implemented, China was in a very special case. It was a highly educated and fairly well-organized society, but its investment levels were incredibly low. After 5 decades of anti-Japanese war, followed by civil war, followed by 30 years of Maoism, the country was hugely underinvested. It had no bridges, it had no subways, it had a very limited train system, it had 4 commercial airports in the entire country, which is the size of the United States, a little bit bigger than the U.S., and had very little manufacturing capacity, et cetera, et cetera. So what China really needed at the time, more than anything else, was a huge amount of investment in infrastructure and in manufacturing capacity. Now, the constraint on investment is, of course, savings, domestic savings and foreign savings. And as a risky developing country, foreigners were quite reluctant to invest a great deal in China. So the constraint on investment became domestic savings. And in order to deal with that constraint, China employed a growth model, which is not unique to China. Quite a lot of countries have followed this model, where basically you force up the savings rate by reducing the amount of GDP that goes to that part of the economy that consumes, which is ordinary households. As you transfer wealth away from ordinary households who consume most of their income and pass it on to the rich or to businesses or to governments who don't consume, you automatically force up the savings rate. It has nothing to do with cultural attitude towards savings. So what China did during this period is, as they grew, they put into place policies that suppressed the growth of household income. Now, that doesn't mean household income didn't grow. What it means is that household income grew much more slowly than GDP. While GDP was growing at around 10, 11%, household income was growing at roughly 7%. And this is really important because it meant that over this period, from the 1980s until the early part of this century, while GDP was growing quite rapidly, the household income share of GDP contracted to become the lowest household share of GDP in history, roughly 50%. This is important because as you reduce the household share of GDP, then by definition, you're reducing the consumption share and increasing the savings share. And remember, savings was the constraint on Chinese investment. China had huge investment needs, but it was constrained by the lack of savings. So this growth model generated very, very rapid growth and even more rapid growth in savings, which meant even more rapid growth in investment. This is a great economic policy as long as you continue to be underinvested. It's basically supply-side economics. It's a type of trickle-down theory. First, you get the economy growing as rapidly as possible, and that mostly benefits the rich. But because the rich save most of their income, that increases the growth in investment, and the growth in investment eventually trickles down to the household sector, who also benefits from all of that growth. The problem is, once you reach the limit of your ability to absorb additional investment productively, then the model no longer works. And many economists were saying, well, investment in China is about 1/8 the level of investment in the U.S., so basically you can multiply Chinese investment by 8 times before we reach the limits. And that's nonsense, because that assumes every country is equally able to absorb investment productively. And what I would argue is that that's not true. Different countries, based on their institutions, their legal, political, financial, educational, et cetera, institutions, are able to be more or less productive depending on those institutions. What differentiates a poor country from a rich country, it's not that the rich country is rich because it has more bridges. It's the other way around. It has more bridges because it's richer. And it's richer because it has the right set of institutions that allow it to be highly productive. So what that means is that for developing countries, there's an optimal level of investment, which is much lower than it is in the U.S. And in the case of China, I would argue that they reached that optimal level sometime in the late 1990s or the early part of this century. Now, once that happens, what you should do in theory is reform the institutions that determine the productivity with which you can absorb additional resources. And that means changing the political system, the financial system, the legal system, the bankruptcy process, et cetera, et cetera. And all of that is very difficult. Very few countries have been able to do that. But if you don't do that and you continue with very high levels of investment, this investment is going to become increasingly non-productive. And that has a very important impact on the debt, because if I borrow $100 to build the bridge that increases the value of my economy by $110, then although my debt has gone up, my ability to service the debt has gone up even faster. So there's really no debt problem. But if now I'm borrowing $100 to build a bridge that only adds $20 of economic value to the economy, including all of the externalities, then my debt is rising much faster than my ability to service the debt. And I would say China reached that point at some point in the first decade of this century. And once it reached that point, until it radically transformed its growth model towards a consumption growth model, which required a huge redistribution of wealth to the household sector, then almost by definition, the only way you could attain high levels of growth is with even higher levels of debt. So at some point in the first decade, debt levels started to rise. And at first, you know, everyone said it's not a problem. China doesn't have a debt problem. But it already had a serious debt problem because there was no way it could continue growing without an unsustainable increase in the debt. By 2010, 2012, more and more people recognized that there was a debt problem. And certainly by 2019, I think everyone recognizes that China had a significant debt problem. But every time they tried to constrain the growth in debt, if you don't change the model and you try to constrain the growth in debt, you're constraining the growth in investment. And since much of the growth is driven by this non-productive investment, because consumption is too low to matter, then immediately GDP growth drops very, very sharply. So every time they tried to constrain the growth in debt, GDP growth slowed so sharply that they would panic and they would step on the accelerator again. Last year, we saw the debt to GDP ratio, the official debt to GDP ratio, rise from a very high 249% to 254%. So it increased by a little over 6 percentage points. What COVID-19 has done is it's accelerated that entire process. We don't know how much debt will go up this year. So far, it's gone up tremendously. But using pretty simple calculations, it's very hard for me to figure out how debt will grow by less than 18 percentage points. The debt to GDP ratio will grow by less than 18 percentage points this year. In other words, from 254% to a minimum of 272, and probably higher than that. So what COVID-19 has done in China, like it's done everywhere else, it's not really changed anything. It's accelerated all of the problems we've had. Income inequality is worse, the imbalances are worse, the consumption share of GDP is worse, and the increase in debt is much, much worse. And I think that's something that Beijing clearly recognizes, but they're not really sure how to deal with it yet.
Where would China fit in terms of your Minsky-motivated framework for how debt crises get generated? As I said, there's been so much written and a lot of ink spilled on the sense that this was unsustainable and calamity was going to happen. And, you know, we've had some blips along the way. I do want to come back to August of 2015, because that was a really important event in terms of market volatility. But where does China fit in terms of your sense of sustainability and what they need to do and what the risks are of something that becomes less controllable?
In 2015, there was a widespread consensus that China was on the verge of collapse. And I remember the Wall Street Journal came out with an article on the China bulls and China bears. And for the first time ever, I was listed in the China bulls camp because I argued that China would not have a financial crisis. So I've always argued that although China has an unsustainable debt problem, it's unlikely to have a financial crisis. And the reason is because, remember, as we discussed earlier in the interview, I would argue that a financial crisis is a balance sheet problem. It has to do with the mismatching of assets and liabilities. Now, if you look at Chinese balance sheets on paper, they look absolutely terrible. The banking system, particularly the small banks, are heavily dependent on purchase funds, which are very, very volatile. A lot of the assets are worthless and so can't be liquidated, and they're supported by short-term liabilities. So you look at the balance sheets and you'd say China's going to have a financial crisis in 3 weeks. But there's a big difference, and that is that the Chinese banking system is still largely closed. Foreigners play a very small role within the financial system. Foreign portfolio money is quite small. It's about maybe 2 to 3% of the equity market and a similar share, 2 to 3% of the debt market. So it's basically a closed system. And it's a closed system in which the regulators are very powerful and very credible. And what I've been arguing is that as long as it's closed and as long as the regulators are powerful, there is no balance sheet mismatch because the regulators can force creditors to restructure the liabilities at will. So basically, liabilities are infinite. The maturity of the liabilities are infinite. They can be restructured anytime by the regulators. So while you have terrible mismatches on paper, in reality, you don't have mismatches. So China is very unlikely to have a crisis. Now, I say unlikely because as debt levels grow, that creates more fragility within the banking system, and that also undermines the credibility of the regulators. But I still think it's very unlikely to happen. Now, that's not necessarily a good thing. I think if you ask most economists, why is it bad to have too much debt? They will tell you, because if you have too much debt, you might have a crisis, and that's a bad thing. Well, that's totally circular. If it weren't a bad thing, you wouldn't have a crisis. There must be something else that is wrong about too much debt. And I would argue that too much debt, however you want to define it, ends up reducing growth in the long term. It can do it very quickly in the form of a crisis. So in the U.S. and from 1930 to 1933, we had a crisis that caused a 30% contraction in the U.S. economy. It was very brutal, but it was quite quick. Mexico in 1982, Brazil in 1983 had crises and very rapid, brutal adjustments. But that's not the only way you can adjust. There are countries, they typically tend to be larger countries, but like the Soviet Union in the 70s and 80s, or like Japan in the 90s, those countries never had debt crises. They had too much debt, but they never had debt crises. And the form their adjustment took was one or two decades, lost decades, they're called, of economic stagnation. And I think it's really important to understand how great this cost can be. The Soviet Union in the early 70s was the world's second largest economy at 15% of global GDP. And two decades later, when everyone expected the Soviet Union to overtake the U.S. as the world's largest economy, its share of global GDP had actually dropped to around 4 to 5%. Japan, in the early 90s, peaked out at around 17% of global GDP. And 20 years later, and again, back in the late 80s, early 90s, everyone knew that within 20 years, Japan would be the world's largest economy. Instead, its share of global GDP shrank to around 7 to 8%. So what I would argue is that one of the ways you resolve a debt problem is through a debt crisis. Socially and politically, it's incredibly painful. Economically, it's painful but short. And if you don't have a debt crisis, then what you end up doing is resolving it over a much longer period, the cost of which tends to be much, much greater, as exemplified by Japan and the Soviet Union or Russia.
Let's go back, if we can, to this event in August of 2015. So we're on the horizon of the five-year anniversary. It was August 24th, and I'm just looking at some numbers here. The VIX was at 13 on August 17th and closed at 41 on the 24th. I think it hit 50 intraday on that pretty calamitous Monday, owing to some version of a repeg on the currency from China. What do you think that says about the linkages between the U.S. and China? Is that vulnerability a thing of the past? How should we think about the FX relationship and how it might impose itself from a global risk perspective?
I think people overestimated the likely impact of the shift in the PBOC policy, the People's Bank of China policy, on the rest of the world. Now, what happened technically is that the setting of the... So China doesn't really have a peg. It has a band. Every day at 10 o'clock in the morning, the PBOC announces the new parity rate. RMB is allowed to trade within 2% of that parity rate. It's typically set in dollars, although they really think about it in terms of a basket of currencies, but it's set in dollars. And what happened in August 2015 was the PBOC said, okay, from now on, we are no longer going to set the parity rate. It's not going to be a discretionarily set parity rate. What we're going to do is we're going to take the close of the previous day, I think the 4 o'clock rate, and that will become the new parity rate today. Now, that looks like a sort of a floating rate regime, not a pure float because you have that 2% band. But in theory, if the market tries to force the RMB to appreciate or depreciate, that change in the value of the RMB then becomes tomorrow's new parity rate, and the currency can trade up or down 2%, et cetera, et cetera. So it looked like the PBOC was shifting from a fixed exchange rate, where basically the PBOC sets the exchange rate every day at whatever level they want, to a floating rate, in which the level is set not by the PBOC, but by the close of the previous day. So technically, it's a kind of float. But in reality, it never really floated because the PBOC would intervene in the afternoon of that day to make sure it closed at whatever level it wanted it to close at. It would either buy or sell large amounts of dollars in order to force the rate to whatever rate they chose. So legally, it was a major change in the setting of the currency. Practically, there was no change at all. The PBOC continued to decide every day where it wanted the parity rate, but instead of just setting the parity rate, it would intervene in the market the day before to make sure it closed at or near whatever parity rate it wanted. And of course, because of its power over the Chinese commercial banks who dominated the market, it didn't even really need to do much intervention. It simply let the commercial banks know that it was going to defend a certain rate, and the commercial banks then did the work for the PBOC. If the regulator is credible enough, all they have to do is tell you where they want the price to be for the market automatically to adjust to that price. So I think although that terrified the world because they thought what it meant is that now the RMB could shoot to incredibly high levels or collapse to incredibly low levels, and that would have an impact on the capital account and on the trade account, I think they overestimated the impact of that change. China is still a fairly closed economy. It can affect the rest of the world through the current account, but in terms of the capital account, reserves have been pretty stable since 2016. And while there are no more restrictions, the ability of foreign investors to invest in Chinese stocks and Chinese bonds, all of the QFII restrictions have been removed. The fact is foreigners are rapidly growing, but they're still quite small. I haven't seen the latest numbers, but I would guess that portfolio inflows represent maybe 2% of the trading volume of the stock market and maybe 2 to 3% of the bond markets. Now, this could change. It could be in 2 or 3 years that foreigners represent 20%, 30% of these markets, as they do in other developing countries. If that happens, then all bets are off. Then we're talking about a very, very different market dynamic. But for now, we have to think that the Chinese financial markets are still largely closed. And so the transmission of shocks from abroad into China or from China abroad through the capital account are pretty limited. It would occur through the real economy if there were real transmission shocks.
You mentioned this notion of shocks and how they're transmitted. Well, nothing shocked the world more than this sudden stop that we experienced globally back in March. And I had talked about the VIX going to 40 in August 2015. Well, it hit a new all-time high in March at 83 this year. Just the force of the financial market reaction from this, you know, forced shutdown of the economy was quite striking, and government intervention both by in the U.S., the Congress and administration, and then, of course, the Fed was quite forceful. We're in the cleanup program now of trying to figure out how to work through this or buy enough time, and there's just a tremendous amount of debt being issued globally, certainly in the U.S. And then there's a lot of talk about the new paradigm. I've seen you've done some writing on MMT. I'd love to get your take on what that means, modern monetary theory. It seems to be a phrase that people view differently, but I'm curious what your thoughts are in terms of how it might work in today's circumstance, its applicability. What do you see just in terms of the way forward from a monetary policy standpoint?
Well, the basic insight of MMT is 100% correct, and it's true by definition. You can't even really argue whether you agree or disagree. The problem is that there's a lot of confusion about what the implications are. The original insight of MMT is that with a fiat currency, governments face no funding constraint. So this idea that if you want to spend money, you have to first raise it through taxes is simply not true. Governments can spend whatever money they like. There's no constraint at all. But what some people have interpreted that to mean is that there is no real constraint at all on the ability of governments to spend money or to borrow. And I think that's where the confusion lies. In a well-functioning economy in which there is a little excess capacity, in which everybody is working, if the government were to increase expenditures dramatically, either by creating money or by borrowing money, what they would end up doing is they would end up boosting demand without in any way affecting supply. And so if demand goes up and supply doesn't change, then you need some kind of adjustment mechanism, and basically the adjustment mechanism occurs through inflation. Inflation, as you know, is just a tax. The only point of inflation is to balance supply and demand by extracting demand from anyone who is long monetary assets. So if you own bonds or if you own cash, you lose out in inflation, and your demand goes down in line with the increase in government demand. But that's not necessarily what has to happen. Under certain conditions, an increase in government demand can also increase supply. So, for example, if you believe that the U.S. is underinvested in infrastructure and the government simply goes out and either creates money or borrows money, it doesn't really matter, and builds necessary highways or repairs the road system in New York or whatever you like, whatever productive investment would be. In that case, demand does go up because the government is creating additional demand, but supply also goes up because the government is creating additional productive capacity in the economy. So I think the correct lesson to draw from MMT is not that governments can do whatever they want. The correct lesson to draw is that if there is productive activity that the government can engage in, either redistributing wealth downwards or building infrastructure, productive infrastructure, then there is no monetary constraint. There is no constraint on its ability to fund it. It can simply go out and do it. If it creates money, that's not inflationary because demand goes up and supply goes up. If it borrows the money, that doesn't worsen the debt burden because, yes, debt goes up, but GDP also goes up by even more. And so debt servicing capacity goes up by even more. So I think we have to be really, really careful about MMT. The limited definition of MMT is absolutely correct. There is simply no way you can disagree. The government has no funding constraint at all. It can spend as much money as it likes. But that doesn't mean it should spend as much money as it likes. What it means is that if the government spends money in ways that increase investment in productive activity, then there is no consequence. There's no inflation, there's no need to tax, there's no worsening of the debt burden. But if it spends money in ways that increase demand without increasing supply, then it's going to be inflationary, and then it becomes a much more difficult policy issue.
Certainly was a lot of focus in markets over the last couple of years with the Trump trade war and the negotiations on a trade deal. Seemed like it was progressing, and then the world came upon COVID, and that's obviously created a much new and deeper strain in terms of the U.S.-China relationship. What do you see as the pathway forward for the United States and China, and what are the implications for the global economy?
I think there's a real problem with the global trade and capital regime. And in fact, that was really the purpose of the book Matt Klein and I wrote, Trade Wars or Class Wars, which came out 3 months ago. And the problem is that in this hyper-globalized world that we live in, countries want to increase their competitiveness. And there's two ways you can increase competitiveness. One way is to invest in increasing the productivity of workers, that means that you end up producing more stuff. It doesn't mean you run a trade surplus. It means you end up producing more stuff, and you can exchange it for increasing amounts of foreign goods for each unit of production. So your reward for increasing productivity is not a trade surplus. It's that you're able to import more and more for the amount of stuff that you produce. But the other way to improve competitiveness is to lower wages. You can lower them directly, like Germany did in 2003, 2004 with the Hartz reforms, or you can lower them indirectly by weakening your currency or by environmental degradation, which is a form of lowering wages, or by undermining the social safety net, et cetera, et cetera. The point is that if you do it the latter way, it's a classic beggar thy neighbor policy. So I directly or indirectly lower the wages in my country. That means that because the wages that go to workers or to middle-class households is mostly used for consumption, by lowering wages, I am reducing consumption and reducing my contribution to global demand. But the benefit that I get is that I get a bigger share of global demand because I'm able to, by reducing wages, I'm able to underprice my global competitors. Now, the problem is if I'm the only person doing that, that's fine. I benefit. I get more growth at your expense, but fine. But that's not how it works because to the extent that I do it, you have to do it. So we get locked into a world, and we have been for three or four decades now, where for reasons of competitiveness, you cannot allow increases in productivity to translate into increases in wages. And so we've been stuck in this system in which growth isn't very strong, but growth in wages is actually weaker than growth in GDP. And the only thing that's keeping growth, even at these levels, is a significant rise in household debt, because consumers aren't able to consume as much as they want based on their wages. So in order to meet their consumption targets, they have to borrow. And that's the world that we've sort of locked ourselves into. So what I would argue is that the Trump approach to trade reflected a real problem. There is a real problem with global trade. Basically, foreigners, Japanese, Chinese, Germans, etc., they're achieving trade surpluses not because they work harder or because they're more prudent. That's nonsense. They're achieving trade surpluses because what they pay their workers relative to productivity is lower than what the rest of the world pays. So, for example, the average American worker is 125% as productive as the average German worker. Let me see if I'm getting my numbers right. And the average English worker is about 80% as productive as the average German worker. The average German worker gets paid as much as the English worker, who is less productive, and he gets paid much less than the American worker, who is one quarter, again, as much productive, but ends up getting paid something like 35% more. My point is that German competitiveness is not because German workers are very productive. They're less productive than Americans, and they're a little bit more productive than English. But German competitiveness is based on the fact that German workers are paid much less relative to their productivity than either Americans or English. And that's what creates these imbalances. If you lower the cost of German workers, then German workers end up consuming a smaller share of what they produce, and so more of it has to be exported abroad. So the reason countries like Germany and China and Japan run large trade surpluses is because their workers are paid less relative to productivity in their trade partners. And the problem with that, of course, is that the trade partners have to respond with lowering their workers' wages, and it becomes a race to the bottom. So this is a real problem, and this had to be resolved. And I think the fact that it was a problem was an important part. In fact, I think there's a lot of evidence that says the fact that trade was a problem was an important part of the reason for Trump's victory in 2016. Those areas most badly hurt by trade were those areas most likely to vote for Trump. So there's a real problem there. Unfortunately, Washington did not react in the right way, because by trying to resolve the problem by imposing tariffs on Chinese goods, I think they were really aiming at a sort of a political effect rather than a real economic effect. Because the point is, as long as Chinese workers are paid less relative to what they produce than American workers, then China must run a current account surplus, and the United States must run a current account deficit, not necessarily with each other, but they must, on an overall basis, run these types of imbalances. So what happens is that if U.S. puts tariffs on Chinese goods, that will reduce the bilateral imbalance. The American deficit with China will go down. The Chinese surplus with the United States will go down. But it will be dollar for dollar replaced by a higher American deficit with the rest of the world and a higher Chinese surplus with the rest of the world. And that's exactly what happened. In a world in which it is capital flow imbalances that drive the trade imbalances, you can't solve the problem by taxing trade, by putting tariffs on trade. You must solve the problem on the capital side, perhaps by imposing capital controls or putting taxes on capital inflows or whatever. There's 100 ways of dealing with it. But just to summarize, I'm aware that this has been a very long answer, but just to summarize, Trump was addressing a real problem. He was just addressing it completely incorrectly. And my guess is that whoever wins this year, and it looks like it's going to be Biden, but either way, they're going to have to address this problem of trade and capital imbalances, because it's a real problem for the United States and for the world.
Your book, Trade Wars or Class Wars, comes at a really unique time. And I think the way in which you and Matthew Klein relate the economics of these trade imbalances with the angst, as you say, that maybe the Trump voter and constituency was feeling is quite important. And congratulations on the book. It's excellent work.
Thanks very much.
Well, Michael, this has been a great conversation. I really appreciate your time. Our audience of listeners will definitely appreciate your insights on the history of crises and also your current interpretation of vulnerabilities in the world and specifically on China. Thanks very much, Michael. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Dean.
You've been listening to the Alpha Exchange. If you've enjoyed the show, please do tell a friend. And before we leave, I wanted to invite you to drop us some feedback. As we aim to utilize these conversations to contribute to the investment community's understanding of risk, your input is valuable and provides direction on where we should focus. Please email us at feedback@alphaexchangepodcast.com. Thanks again, and catch you next time.